the dual child motif, it's the child with a dual destiny. It's the Christ figure who carries his awareness that he is combining in himself both a spiritual and a material reality. That he has two parents, one from heaven, one from the earth. And this is his human suffering, his human struggle. He has immortal longings that are not satisfied except by the newness. He lives a life of suffering in the body, and finally at the end gives up, surrenders, because he can see a larger story that is built out of both of these truths, his spiritual destiny and his material destiny as a human being. So we're going to be talking a lot this weekend about this intermediate space. Tomorrow I'll be introducing the whole idea of two worlds and the space between them. But for now, this is enough to just at least whet your appetite for this dual child motif, because this is the thing that I've been discovering in the what I call the self-care system. So to continue with this very difficult quote from Jung, Edward Edinger, in his book Ego and Archetype, confesses that the full implications of this idea that individuality has an a priori unconscious existence might be missed. He says, a mythological image that says the same thing conveys much more adequately the impact of its meaning. Quote, in the Gospel of Luke, when the people are rejoicing that they have power over the demons, Jesus replies, don't rejoice in this, that the spirits are subject to you, but rejoice that your names are written in heaven. Edinger goes on, this is the fuller meaning of the abstract statement that individuality has an a priori unconscious existence. One's name is written in heaven. In other words, one's unique individuality has a transpersonal origin and justification for being. And Edinger goes on to point out that this image is enriched by referring to the ancient idea, and it's widespread throughout Western thought, that each person has his or her own heavenly star, a kind of celestial counterpart representing his cosmic dimension and destiny. So the star over the Christ child in Bethlehem would be a familiar example for us in the Christian West. Okay? Wordsworth captures this idea. Next slide. Our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting. The soul that rises with us, our life star, hath had elsewhere its setting and cometh from afar. Not in entire forgetfulness and not in utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory do we come from God who is our home. So the idea expressed in these romantic notions is that each person, each one of us, brings into the world an eternal archetypal essence, a star, and that the goal of psychological development is to incarnate that core in the vicissitudes of temporal existence and try to realize it, make it real, as best we can. That's always an approximation. And, you know, we never know for sure whether we're on the light beam of that core self or not. It requires a certain discernment of the spirits, as Ignatius of Loyola used to say. But the point is, we have this dual destiny, and we have these immortal longings, and we also are instinctual creatures driven by biological, infantile, and totally material drives, just like Freud said we were. So, we straddle those two worlds, and for Jung, the important thing is that in addition to the hunger instinct and the sexual instinct and the aggressive instinct, we have these religious instincts. And he said the religious instinct is only satisfied by a numinous experience. mystical experiences or moments of oneness or moments of satori or in meditation or in deep loving relationships with other people, you know what we're talking about. Now, Jung always had premonitions of his dual destiny as a person. If you remember from his autobiography, he describes his struggle between his number one and his number two personalities. The part of him that was embedded in external reality as the number one, who was a good boy, kept his ears clean, went to school, did his homework, all that sort of thing. And then his number two personality that was really quite unadapted to the outer world, but was at home in the imagination, in what he called God's world. And especially in nature, he felt really deeply connected to God's world in nature. And one of the things that Jung discovered, and this was around the time that he was starting the journal entries that resulted in his now famous Red Book, was that the sacred spiritual dimension of his being came forward in the image of a symbolic child. Now, he found this out, if you're students of Jung's writing, you know how this went. He was thrilled to meet Freud in 1902. The two of them set about collaborating and became the two major giants that promulgated the whole psychoanalytic movement in the early decade of the 20th century. They lectured together at Clark University. They lectured all over Europe together. They made a journal. They wrote together. When they first met, they spent 14 hours in conversation. We couldn't pry them apart. They were just two giants who had found each other. And what they had discovered was the psyche. They had discovered the unconscious. Jung was busy discovering the unconscious with what was called the word association test. Freud was busy discovering the unconscious through dreams of his patients, through his own dreams, and through the kinds of associations that came up when he put somebody on a couch and said, now think of the first thing that comes to your mind. And all kinds of things were pouring out. So they collaborated, they loved each other, they formed this incredible attachment. And then Jung began to be dissatisfied with Freud's one-dimensional, one-worldly interpretation of dream material and unconscious material. And Jung kept trying to interest Freud in the idea that there were archetypal fundaments underneath the personal associations that his patients were having. That behind every personal mother there was the great mother. That behind every infantile pain and suffering there was the symbolic image of the child. And so he went back in mythology and started gathering together the relevant archetypal symbolism, and he decided he had to add a whole layer to the unconscious underneath what Freud called the personal unconscious. So Jung added the collective unconscious underneath this. And he wrote a book, which is now volume 5 of the collected works, called Symbols of Transformation. And he was terrified that it would cost him his relationship with Freud. And his wife even intervened and wrote to Freud saying, Carl is so anxious about how you're going to receive this. Please be gentle with him. Because she knew, and Jung knew, that because of the religious and spiritual intonations of what... Because see, the collective unconscious is the arena through which our spiritual experiences come to us. That's Jung's idea. So they knew that Freud wouldn't like this, and he didn't. And he started to denigrate Jung and to marginalize him, and the letters grew more and more contentious and adversarial. And finally, there occurred a break in 1912, 10 years after they first met, that absolutely destroyed Jung's identity. He was now a pariah in the movement he had helped start. And Freud denigrated him to all the other members of the psychoanalytic circle. It got so bad that Freud actually got together a group of 8 men, including Ranke, Ferenczi, Jones, Eidington, and he gave them all rings. And he said, "You will be the faithful group, and there will be no deviation." Now, of course, he couldn't enforce that because all the creative ones left him. Ranke left him, Ferenczi left him, Adler left him. Everybody left him. But Jung was the first, and the ring cycle was Freud's effort to ensure fidelity to the core dogma. But when this happened to Jung, he descended into despair, and he didn't know what to do. Everybody had forsaken him. Nobody would respond. There were one or two in the Zurich community that he led, really, at the Berkowski, that stayed faithful to him. But for 28 nights, he was up all night long listening to the voices of mockery. Now, those were partly, you know, the people that started to mock him in his own community, but they were amplified by the dark angel. They had now become really archetypal voices of denigration and shaming. And Jung spent 28 nights, he was in near despair, he was frozen, he was completely dead inside, he was depressed. Then one night, he picked up his pen, and we can only imagine what this must have been like for him, because in the Memories, Dreams, Reflections, he said, "At that moment, I let myself drop." In other words, he stopped trying to hold himself together. He stopped arguing with his voices. He did what Pema Chodron advises all of us. Let your heart break and drop the story. Let your heart break and drop the story. And Jung let his heart break. And he wrote in the Black Book, meine Seele, wo bist du? My soul, where are you? I have returned, please, I am here again. Do you still know me? Give me your hand, my almost forgotten soul. And Jung continues to write, this is in the very beginning of the Red Book now. I wandered for many years, so long that I forgot I possessed a soul. I belonged to men and things, but I did not belong to myself. I had to become aware that I had lost you. I had lost you, my soul. And then Jung heard a response. His soul appeared in the voice, an image of a child. "Who are you, child?" Jung asked. "My dreams have represented you as a child or as a maiden. I am ignorant of your mystery. Please forgive me. Please help me understand how strange it sounds for me to call you a child, you who still hold the all without end in your hand. I went on the way of the day and you went invisibly with me. You upheld my belief when I was alone and near despair. At every decisive moment, you let me believe in myself." Then Jung concludes that, this quote, "The spirit of the depths taught me that my life is encompassed by the divine child. From his hand, everything unexpected came to me, everything living. This child is what I feel as an eternally springing youth in me. I had to recognize and accept, and it wasn't easy for him, that my soul is a child and that my God in my soul is a child." Now later, Jung generalized his personal discovery. In fact, you can try the next one. He wrote, "In every adult, there lurks a child, an eternal child. Something that is becoming is never completed and calls for unceasing care, attention, and education. That is the part of the human personality that wants to develop and become whole." Now, what Jung is really talking about there is what he would describe as the divine child, the spark of the spirit, the recovery of his own innocence on another level somehow. And we have the next slide. Now, here's the image that I'll be asking you to think about along with me this weekend. This is Blake's image of the good and evil angels struggle for possession of a child. And on the left, you see the dark angel, Lucifer, shackled to his flaming darkness, reaching out with deadened eyes, trauma-trance eyes, really, trying to find this child. The child is terrified, fleeing into the arms of the bright angel. Now, we'll be talking about this image in different iterations throughout the weekend, but what I want to try to interest you in is I got acquainted with the guy on the left with the shotgunner behind the curtain. Right? And I got acquainted with the light angel, with my patient whose angel appeared by her dying body, and also by the little girl who said the angel won't let me go in. This angel on the right tends to be much more protective. She tends to try to protect the wounded child from too much pain, from too much suffering. However, both these angels are devoted to the project of what I call dissociation. We can't throw our allegiance in completely with the angel on the right, because she's protective, because she also, both these angels are part of the dissociative system. They are in business to keep the innocent part of the person. Is this still working?
It's going on and off.
It's going on and off? Okay. It's good now? Okay, maybe I have to stand still. Okay, if I do that, okay. I'll try to face forward. So, the angel on the right, while the angel on the left dissociates the psyche and tries to attack the connections between painful affect, feelings of vulnerability and hurt, and the conscious ego, the angel on the right takes the child into an encapsulation, promises oblivion and bliss, frequently tries to seduce the child into drugs or alcohol. And she is no bargain either. I say she because I tend to think of her as a she. But that's not clear in Blake's image at all. So the light and dark angels then are part of an effort on the part of a defensive structure, which is really a self-regulation structure. I call this the self-care system, because it's an effort at regulation of how much consciousness of affect in the body gets experienced by the ego, especially how much consciousness of pain and suffering. When people come to us with a trauma history, they have a great deal of unconscious suffering. They don't know what it is. Plus, they're identified with these angels. One part of them can blow up and become enraged. Another part of them can become extremely protective and solicitous of wounded creatures all over the planet. I had one woman identified with the bright angel who literally could not pass as she drove through the roads of Westchester County, where I practiced. She could not pass animals that were dying on the pavement from roadkill. And she was notorious to all the vets in the area, because she took injured turtles and snakes and rabbits and even deer into the vets to try to get them repaired and saved. Now, this woman could feel complete compassion for innocent animals, but she had no compassion for her husband, who failed her perfectionistic ideal. side and down the other, and she was quite tyrannical with him. It was like really two complete sides to her personality as she channeled one angel and then another into her marriage.